A few weeks ago, I told you guys that we had a resident microphone expert, along with our audio expert, Rob. In the office today with me is Johnny Zinniger, who, what is your official title, Johnny?
Well, I think they call me a senior tech, but that just means I'm an old guy. So I'm actually disguised as a studio engineer, so I call myself an engineer.
All right, and as far as Rob and I are concerned, and probably a lot of other people at APH, there's not many people that know more about microphones and digital recording than Johnny. And you brought up some things for show and tell up here today, I understand.
Yeah. Right now, Rob has the an ElectroVoice RE27 microphone. And unfortunately, we're not going to be plugging in and trying it out this time, but... as a matter of fact, I have to get it back to the studio and for the next session. But it's a large diaphragm dynamic microphone, and it's just makes a wonderful broadcast type or recording microphone. It has ports that reduce the proximity effect, which most cardioid microphones possess. And that's beneficial to us because the narrators move their heads around and top to the bottom of the page or whatever on books. And you would, if in close proximity, you would notice that change in low frequency response. So these mics are specifically designed to minimize that.
So what you have is you have a grill on the front, and then the grill actually is open on both sides as you move toward the back of the microphone. And then there's 8 little ribs on each side, and those are all protected by a grill beyond the ribbing in the case. And it just sort of files back and gets a tiny bit smaller as you go back, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty heavy and large microphone.
It's huge. And we were just thinking, I don't know what the weight is, five pounds maybe?
Or? At least, yeah. Now this is an evolution of the ElectroVoice RE20 mic, which is still heavily used in broadcast applications. Just about any disc jockey that you hear on the radio is going to be using an RE20 mic. Oh. This microphone is essentially the same physical dimensions, but it employs a newer magnet technology. It's neodymium magnets, and it renders a little bit better dynamic range and high frequency response. Actually, the high frequency response is so sharp that I've got these rolled off in our studios to cut back on the sibilance. And when you roll the high end back, it's a little bit more in line with the high frequency response of the RE20. And once again, this is the RE27.
Tell us a little bit about, you have a large windscreen and shock mount on these in the studio, right?
Right. Well, we had to put a shock mount in the studio because basically we were picking up rumble from who knows where. The APH is located within a mile of a railway and 2 major interstates. And believe it or not, even though we have floating concrete floors on cork, you still pick up some of that rumble through the floor. And so we use a shock mount to keep that down. And then we have, we used to use windscreens, but now we use pop filters. The windscreen really didn't do quite as good a job on plosives. And we didn't really have any wind, so they weren't helping us in that regard. But the, as Popper Stopper, I think is the manufacturer's name, and they actually make one that's specifically made for the RE20 and RE27, and it's small. And people used to home make them with an embroidery hoop and just stretch a silk stocking across it.
Yeah.
And it's still useful, but usually, you know, they're 5 inches in diameter, and we try to get the microphones close enough to the narrator that type of screen would interfere with their vision of being able to read the book. And, you know, we try to get them to face the mic so that, you know, that we're not picking up sound from the top of their head or whatever. So we need to have a really, really small screen. And that's why we had been using the foam rubber wind socks. But now with these popper stoppers, they're just, you know, 2.5-3 inches in diameter. They're just barely bigger than the microphone itself. And so it doesn't interfere visually with their being able to read the book.
Huh. Okay. What's roughly the frequency response of something like that?
I think this one's good up to about 18K.
Oh, wow.
And the RE20 was good up to 15K. So
And the low end is?
I'm thinking 40, 45 hertz, somewhere around there. So it's not bad. These mics are also very often used in commercial recording studio applications for kick drums.
Oh, yeah.
And they're often used for low brass trombones and sometimes saxophones. And Knitzer mics, kind of skipping around on some of this, but Knitzer mics often are a little bit too crispy, a little too edgy for a lot of people's tastes on recording certain instruments, so they like to use a dynamic mic. And I guess would this be a good time to basically just talk about the principles of dynamic and condenser mics?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was basically three kinds of mics, a dynamic, a condenser, and a ribbon. The dynamic mic basically operates like a loudspeaker in reverse. It vibrates a thin diaphragm, which is attached to a coil of wire. And as the wire moves through a magnetic field upon vibration, and then an induction creates an electrical output. So that's basically how a dynamic mic works. They're extremely rugged. They resist impacts. They're not susceptible to humidity problems. They're temperature tolerant. Some people use them for hammers. They're on a stage and they're just really, really rugged. And the dynamic element generates enough of an electrical signal to drive a preamp, so you don't have to have any special power or any extra preamplification for it. The negative part is that coil and its associated diaphragm has so much mass that it's hard for it to respond to sharp onset of sound, which we call a transient. And which actually that can be good in some cases because it acts as an ultra-fast compressor. So if you're recording, like I said, a trumpet or a trombone, and you really don't want that real sharp, edgy attack, but you want more of the smoothness, a dynamic mic will work well in that case. Also with drums. Now cymbals, you definitely want a condenser mic because you want that articulation on the high end. But on tom-toms and floor drums and so forth, you really benefit from diminishing that sharp attack. So they're useful for that. And the other negative part of a dynamic mic is that they have a limited frequency response. They seldom get above 15,000 cycles.
Of course, they're also more susceptible to electromagnetic interference, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there's a magnet in there.
Right.
And you don't really have that problem with condenser mics.
No, not at all. A condenser mic, which is really a misnomer, I think accurately they should be called capacitor mics because they operate on a capacitance to modify or create or modify an existing energy, which is the voltage that's applied to a charged backplate. And the condenser uses an ultra-thin diaphragm, and it's suspended above this charged backplate. Due to the electrical principle of capacitance, the voltage between the diaphragm and the backplate changes in proportion to the distance between them. And they must use an impedance conversion amplifier they normally operate at a very high impedance, and you can't send that signal along any distance at all. So they need to have an impedance conversion amplifier, which converts that down to a workable impedance that can be run across long transmission lines. Years ago, before the field effect transistor came around, all condenser mics were really big and bulky, and they had to have a vacuum tube, basically, to do the impedance conversion. And then as soon as the field effect transistor came around, then they started making extremely small condenser microphones. And the interesting thing about the condenser mic is that it just covers the entire span of quality of microphones. On the low end, you have basically all the modern telephones just use a little 50-cent condenser mic element for the mouthpiece, and then it goes all the way up to many thousands of dollars that one can spend for a high-end large diaphragm studio mic. The condenser mics usually come in two flavors. It's a small diaphragm or a large diaphragm. The small diaphragm condenser microphones are usually a fixed pattern. They'll only have an omnidirectional characteristic or a cardioid characteristic. The advantages of the small diaphragm condenser microphones is extreme accuracy. They have frequency responses that go well above the range of human hearing. And the frequency response is very smooth and accurate. So if you're wanting to record an acoustic instrument or cymbals, you know, anything like that, that you want extreme truth and accuracy, you're going to get it with a small diaphragm condenser mic. And they have wonderfully fast transient response and everything. It's the most, a small diaphragm omnidirectional condenser mic is probably the most accurate mic there is available. Conversely, a large diaphragm condenser mic isn't as accurate. They usually have strange frequency humps in their upper frequencies. They'll also have their off-axis response is skewed sometimes. Certain frequencies, it's very strong, and other frequencies, it's very diminished. So they have they don't pick up sound off to the sides nearly as accurately as a small diaphragm mic, and it's probably due to the physical dimension of the mic, of the diaphragm itself. They're an inch wide, so sound coming in from the side is going to hit one side of the diaphragm before it hits the other side, and depending on the phase, or depending on the frequency, the phase anomalies are going to be there. Now, that sounds very undesirable, but actually, that's what people like about large diaphragm condenser mics, and we're speaking on one right now, I believe.
Yeah, this and the Larry's are both large diaphragm.
Yeah, and the neat thing about them is that they have character, and you can go through 25 different large diaphragm condenser microphones, and they'll all have a slightly different flavor. And that's why studio engineers love to have a whole cabinet full of them, because, you know, they'll say, well, this person needs that. They've used this mic in this situation before or whatever. And they'll pull out whichever mic, and at times I'm sure they'll experiment heavily to see which one is going to suit the characteristics that they're trying to attain in their recording. Yeah, it's like I said, it started off sounding like I was really downplaying the large diaphragm condenser mic's capabilities, but it is those anomalies of off-axis response that make them desirable. But once again, if you're wanting extreme accuracy, the small diaphragm in an omni configuration is your best bet.
You don't want to do that in the studio. Because there's some things you want to filter out, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, right now our studios are fairly quiet. In the past, we've had, as many of your listeners may have heard, we've had really reverberant echo chambers that weren't intended to be echo chambers, but our rooms are smaller now, and we have sound deadening material on the sides. Plus, we have the microphones closer to the narrator, so we could get away with an omnidirectional mic in the studio now. But in the past, we definitely needed a highly directional mic. And speaking of pickup patterns, this RE27 we were looking at is a little bit beyond directionality of a normal cardioid, a microphone. Cardioid, by the way, I think pertains to the heart. In the Latin name, cardioid is basically, if you were to visualize the pickup pattern of the microphone, it would be in kind of a little bit of a heart shape or a lobed pickup pattern. Mm-hmm. This RE27, RE20 mic, I believe, are called supercardioids, and they actually, in their design, allow, as Rob was pointing out with the ports on the barrel of the mic, they allow sound to come in from the backside, which minimizes the direction or the sound being picked up from the side by that sound presenting to the back of the diaphragm 180 degrees out of phase. So that's how you get your directionality in a dynamic microphone. And there's a little bit of more of a pickup straight out of the back of the mic because of that, but the benefit is you get more rejection at 90 and 270 degrees off to the sides. And then the next step up from that would be a hypercardioid, which will pick up even a little bit more sound from the rear, but even less on the sides. The directionality is necessary in recording situations, like say for a set of drums where you're not wanting to pick up the other drums next to it. You want to isolate them. Also, the supercardioids and hypercardioids are extremely useful in live music situations, live sound reinforcement, where you don't want to induce feedback, that awful sound. And you know, that was one of the best aspects of the invention of the dynamic microphone when, or I should say the further development of the dynamic microphone. After World War II, magnetic elements got much, much smaller, and that enabled the microphones to be placed in a small package, and so live sound reinforcement took a big boost there. If I could backpedal and get back on the microphones to talk about ribbon mics, because that brings up the directionality aspect as far as the historical development of the microphone. Early carbon mics were the first mics that were invented. I'm trying to remember the name. Alexander Graham Bell, for one, and I think Elijah Gray, I think, who later formed the Western Electric Company. They both applied for a patent on a carbon microphone, it may have been a pre-carbon microphone, back in 1876 on the same day. They tried to get the patent. I think when it went to court, nothing was resolved in either of their favor because it was such a low quality and it was almost unintelligible for speech that, you know, they just said, forget it. But a few years later, a person named David Hughes, it was like late 1800s, I think 1880, somewhere around there. He's the one that came up with the carbon element microphone. And then that was a few years later, maybe 10 years later, Thomas Edison further developed that microphone. And basically that carbon element mic was used for many years until they started experimenting with condenser elements in Germany. Neumann, who later formed a company with his own name, he came out with some early... kind of an involvement of the early carbon mics. But then somewhere in the, I think, 1920s or 30s, somewhere in that range, the ribbon mic was developed. And the ribbon mic was wonderful because it could be made directional. First of all, the early omnidirectional mics and the early carbon mics were all omnidirectional, which is the pressure... It's a pressure-sensitive microphone. It's only picking up sound from one side, so it only will sense pressure coming in from that side. Well, the ribbon mics gave you a velocity or pressure gradient microphone where it actually could receive information from both sides. And the way a ribbon mic is designed is there's a piece of what's like aluminum foil. It's a very thin metal that's stretched just tight enough to not be floppy. And it's stretched in a very strong magnetic field, and then electricity is developed by the vibration of that element moving inside that magnetic field. Mm. The ribbon microphones, as that element moves back and forth, it flexes. That's how your electricity is picked up.
But so those are self-generating?
Yes, there's no power applied to them at all. That was a nice benefit too. You didn't have to have power applied.
Wherever the carbon, you did, right?
Yes. Well, not. I'm not really sure about a carbon mic. Yes, I guess it did have to have some type of polarization. Hmm. But yes, the ribbon operated like a dynamic in that it was self-generating.
Okay.
So it was a bidirectional mic, and if that's the other pattern besides omni and cardioid, is figure eight pattern. But RCA, I think in the 40s, figured a way to put a like a shutter behind the microphone element, and be able to partially let some of the sound come through and reject some of it. And that created the phase cancellation, which gave them a directional pattern. So then now you could use microphones in live public address situations, and the early ribbon mics were used very heavily for that. The negative part of a ribbon mic is that element is so delicate and so fragile. And you can blow on the element and stretch it and actually ruin it. Also, if a dirty or an ill-wired phantom power source is it applied to a ribbon mic, it can pop that element out too. But RCA was the forerunners for affordable microphones that weren't so touchy as far as the humidity conditions go, like condenser mics are. The problem with the condenser mic is that the early mics, they would pick up, if the humidity was high, they'd actually have a scratchy kind of sound because the high humidity would actually cause a coupling of the impedance coupling. So they would go, have this scratchy kind of sound.
I've heard of that. Thankfully, I haven't experienced it.
Well, the designs are much more stable these days than back in the 30s and 40s. But the ribbon mic, back on the other attributes of a ribbon mic, is that they have, because they don't have that mass to overcome like a dynamic mic, they have an extremely fast transient response. But they also have a natural high-frequency roll-off, a very smooth high-frequency roll-off. And that's extremely desirable, especially nowadays with digital recording where you get everything that you ask for in the high end. And it's undesirable a lot of times to have that much. Condenser mics can be characterized as very crisp and even brittle. And the ribbon mic, having that high-frequency roll-off, and we're talking about on the order of 10 dB, down 10 dB at their highest reproduction ranges, which is like 14 or 15,000 hertz. So it's still enough to get enough high-end for intelligibility, but it just smooths it and rolls it off. They're very effective on the human voice, also brass instruments, and very heavily used for that. And ribbon mics, I think because of the digital age, are making a really big comeback. There's several manufacturers of them. For many years, they just about went out of existence. I think Beyer and Kohl's were the only people making them. But now there's a company on the market called Royer. And have you heard of them, Ron?
No.
It's my understanding. I've heard them recorded. I've not had one in my hand before. But there's a Royer stereo microphone that everybody says that's just it as far as stereo recording it. They're wonderful. And I think they're fairly pricey, about $2,000. But Royer also makes a phantom powered ribbon microphone that I don't know, seems odd, but they're using phantom power for a preamplification circuit inside of the microphone. There's actually some dynamic mics using phantom power these days to help them with the long cable runs. Yeah, it's really strange, but
wow.
So anyway, the directionality then of the condenser mics had to keep up with what the ribbon was doing, so they started coming up with multiple elements. And your high-end large diaphragm condenser mic will have a second element on the back side, and they'll use that for multi-pattern configurations. They'll either use just one in the front for a cardioid or omni, or they'll use both for a figure eight pattern, or they will change the phase relationship. Well, they'll change the voltage polarity applied to one of the backplate of one of the elements in order to give your cardioid patterns.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So there, and I believe the mic that Larry has over there, the AKG, was a C3000?
It is, and it claims to be a combination of large and small diaphragm.
Yeah, and it uses this small diaphragm in the back to actually attain hypercardioid capabilities.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, it can't be omnidirectional, but...
Yeah.
And that hypercardioid mode is effective. I've tested it. Mm-hmm. I think it diminishes the sensitivity a little bit. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah.
But it really does work in some situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, if when someone's choosing a microphone, you know, the things that you look for, obviously you want to determine what you want to record first, but omnidirectional mics, as I said earlier, are the most accurate, especially in the condenser form. They have, you know, just perfectly smooth frequency responses. But they pick up a more diffuse sound field, and which is great. It gives you a sense of space and context. You know, you basically can hear the size of the room with an omnidirectional mic because it is picking up everything coming around. I think, Larry, you've got some in-ear microphones, right? Those are omnis. And yeah. And it's just amazing the spatial feel that you get out of those microphones.
It really is, and especially when you wear them right, I found out. Because I was wearing them above my ears up here, like hooking them over like glasses.
Yeah.
But I found out you're supposed to put it in this part of your ear, apparently.
Right.
And yeah. I had even tried them down here in the hole and everything. But
well, actually, I've got a pair, and I use them in the hole of my ear, just like they were an earphone.
And apparently the shape of your ear helps actually guide more sound in there
right.
or something.
Right. It probably helps the frequency response a little bit, too. And it's using your head as to separate the left and right side and for spaciousness and a nice, you know, feel of the way things really sound, that you can't beat that. However, they lack clarity and intelligibility, which you get that with a directional mic, because you're excluding all the stuff off from the side. So if you really want to clearly pick up the source, a directional mic is going to be better. So the cardioid pattern would win out there. The negative part of a cardioid pattern, though, is a something called proximity effect. And I think we discussed that earlier on this EV mic that we use in the APH studios. The closer you get to a cardioid microphone element, the more increased low frequencies are. I brought along Rob, check this out. That is the holy grail of handheld vocal microphones.
Okay.
And I'm sure you know what it is.
The 57.
That's a 58.
58?
Yeah, the 57 is the instrument version.
Oh, 57 is the instrument one.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And it's got a blast filter on the top of it, but man, you get that thing close to your mouth when you're using it, and just the low frequencies go crazy.
Oh, really?
So generally speaking, when they're used in sound reinforcement, and someone is using it right up against their mouth, you've got to roll a considerable amount of bottom end out, especially if the subject has an extremely efficient low frequency response, then you really got to roll it out on those. I also have here the newer version, which is a Beta 58, and dimension wise it's the very same, but just like this Electro Voice RE27, it has the neodymium magnets inside of it to give it more sensitivity and extended high frequency response.
Okay.
And they're probably slowly taking over. There's still people that swear by the original 58, but
you hear a lot about them.
Yeah,
and of course these are Shure mics, if anybody's wondering.
Right,
And they're still available today.
Absolutely,
around for both a very long time, but you can still buy these. And while I haven't actually experienced one yet, I will at some.
You
point.
Will,
right?
You're going to take those home with you, right?
Oh, okay, yeah. And there you go. This one seems a little smaller. Maybe not. It could be. Maybe
yeah. Just, it doesn't have that rubber band around the windscreen.
What's that to help it from not rolling? Or
I don't know.
Yeah.
So something it doesn't make do, so much right? noise when you set it down right? or something. I don't know. You see these, Larry? That's the old 58, and that is an old mic too, by the way.
It feels old.
20 years old.
It's very old. Yeah. It's definitely seen some travel.
Yeah, it has. And then
these are pretty small mics.
Yeah,
they're not terribly big. They have sold millions of them. There's so many out there, and it's popular. It's neat that they're still being made too.
Does this one have the switch or no?
No, it doesn't have a switch. I think the newer versions of the 58 may have a switch.
You can get it with or without.
Version, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Can we use these in the studio sometimes?
No.
No?
No, I wouldn't dare use them in the studio.
They're good enough. Huh?
They're really good for what they do, you know, rock and roll screaming.
And that's what we want to that's one of my goals, to help people understand that the microphone area is so vast.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you might be happy just going down the street and buying whatever mic you can get your hands on. It may meet your need, but if you want to get a little bit more involved in that, it becomes a real brain challenge to figure out, well, gee, what's the best bargain? What kind of things do I want to record? What kind of frequency range do I need if I want it to be directional? Is it going to have to be rugged? What about handling noise? Am I going to hold it, or am I going to have it on a stand? I couldn't believe when we started looking at microphones in the late 90s when we got you involved with that C3000.
Right.
How many different kinds of microphones there actually are.
Yeah. and since then, the large diaphragm, inexpensive condenser microphone has just gone nuts. That the market is crazy. This mic that we're speaking on right now, what did that cost?
$60.
$60.
That's just mind-boggling.
It is.
You couldn't get a large diaphragm condenser mic for under $500, 5 years ago, or that's maybe amazing. A little more than that. But so I guess these other folks figured out, hey, there's no big secret to these mics. We can make them. And as in response, Neumann and AKG, they've had to come up with, microphones that, anybody can afford. They're still not as cheap as some of these Asian models, but they're still much more affordable. Well, like the one you're speaking on, Larry, that's what, around three?
We pay about $300 for that.
Right.
And then unfortunately, about a week later, you told me you saw it for $235. They discontinued it.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they discontinued it. Oh, and that was right around that time they came out with the C3000B.
Oh. Well, they didn't discontinue it. They just added a B to it.
Well, yeah. They essentially made our model go away. That's the other downside to all this. Technology in the area of microphones. I mean, you may buy something that they probably, they have a pretty long life, right? I mean, like, for example,
sure, absolutely.
But, not nearly as bad as a computer or a car.
Oh, no.
But they do go away eventually, so sometimes when you see one you like, if you're sure you like it, you might want to get your hands on two of them if you want to use them as a stereo pair.
Right.
Let's talk about the little XY real quick.
Okay.
The term often used to use two mics in a stereo configuration is an XY pair, right?
Right.
And tell us how you would, if the average person wants to just take a pair of mics they have around the house and record some stuff with stereo imaging, what's the best way to set those up?
Well, there's a number of ways, right? It just depends on which one works the best for you after you listen to them. The coincident or XY configuration is where you basically would place the elements on top of each other as closely as you can possibly get them, with the diaphragms of the mics just barely extending out from each other. So you follow that, the way they're basically crossed.
Do we have the other 50?
Oh, sure, sure. Okay.
Yeah. So we've got them very close together?
No, you put them on top of each other, actually.
On top of each other.
Yeah, on top of each other, 90 degrees.
So,
to each other.
Like this.
Exactly.
Okay. So we have one mic on top of the other, and they're 90 degrees. The diaphragm is 90 degrees from 90 degrees from each other.
That's correct. And the reason you don't want them side to side is because you'll pick up too many phase reflections, or too many reflections off one mic, and it would affect the other one. It would give you phase smearing, and would adversely affect your sound.
So with the microphone shaped more like the 990, the traditional popular,
it'd be very difficult to do. Yeah. So what you would do with those mics is align the microphones in what you would call a near coincident a configuration, and you still get them as closely as you can, but side by side, pointing away from each other at, like I say, 70, 80, 90 degrees.
Oh, okay.
So the MXL that Rob was speaking of is a mic that is oriented up and down. It's a side address microphone instead of like a handheld vocal mic.
Right.
And so you would just point its element out to the left and another element out to the right of the other mic, and they would still be 90 degrees to each other.
Similar to this.
Yeah, stand them as close as you can, and that's considered a near coincident microphone pattern.
Okay. And we always want them as close as we can, though. There's nothing, no truth in the idea, well, I want maybe 3 feet between
the
two.
Well, there's the spaced version. And if you're going to space your microphones for stereo pickup, you want to go, you want to have them fairly far apart because you don't want them picking up directly the same sounds, because then you'll get a rather large buildup of sound in the middle, and also you can suffer from phase anomalies by high frequency sounds reaching each microphone at a slightly different time.
Right.
And by pointing them 90 degrees away from each other, you minimize that, because the largest amount of their lobe or their pickup pattern is not going to overlap.
Hmm. And would you have them still pointing 90 degrees from each other, or would you point them straight if they're really far away?
If they're really far away, you would point them straight.
That's what I thought.
Right.
Okay.
Point them straight ahead. But you want to have them, it's going to depend on what you're recording. Generally speaking, if you use two mics on anything, you should use a 3-to-1 rule, which means the mics should be 3 times further apart than they are from the source.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's going to help ensure that you don't get any weird phase anomalies.
Okay. It's
phase anomalies, the symptom is you'll just have a sometimes as severe as a combing effect, or just a hollow kind of sound where you get some frequencies that build up and some are minimized. It's basically like walking into a room that has square dimensions, and certain frequencies will resonate and they'll be really loud, and other frequencies, you don't notice the ones that aren't there as much as the ones that are amplified. But what happens is every frequency of sound has a different wavelength. And if the geometry of the room happens to line up so that when a sound hitting one wall bounces off and goes back towards the other wall and happens to hit that sound at exactly the right phase, then those frequencies can build up and stack on top of each other, making that particular frequency sound twice as loud as it really is. By the same token, they can hit opposite and create a 180-degree out-of-phase condition, and that frequency will be diminished. Like, once again, you don't notice the holes nearly as much as the buildup. That's why studios are always built with non-parallel walls, so you're not getting those frequencies bouncing from one wall to the next back and forth over and over. You want to splay your walls in a studio configuration so that the sound will hit a wall and either be directed towards the floor, the ceiling, or off to the left or right. And that's the way our APH studios are. So basically that happens, you know, when you have microphones too close to each other, they pick up the sound from a source at slightly different times, and those phase anomalies can cause cancellation or or a buildup of those certain frequencies.
And especially if you're going to convert this down to mono for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Then you're in trouble.
Absolutely.
You've got smeared high end because of timing differences.
Yeah.
And very possibly a lot of low frequency bizarreness too.
Absolutely. There is another stereo recording configuration which is going to help that situation where you reduce to mono, but it's not a widely known or heavily used configuration. It's called MS or midside.
Midside. Tell us all about midside.
Well, I don't know all about midside, but I'll tell you what I do know about it. It basically uses a cardioid microphone, a directional microphone in the center, pointed right straight towards the sound source, and then just behind it, it will use a figure eight microphone, which is turned 90 degrees to the front-facing mic. And then that is picking up sound from the left and right.
Okay.
Then it uses, and I really don't know the mechanics of it, but it uses a sum difference matrix, which it's a circuit that will take that side information that the rear mic gives you and use it to give you a stereo image through this sum difference. You know, it takes some of the frequencies and adds them to what's coming out of the front and takes others and subtracts them from it.
Yeah, because the center is used as the root, essentially, and you're
exactly.
Working from that. You take the other mic and subtract it from the center.
Right. The benefit of this type of recording is that if you do want to take this stereo mix and put it down to mono, you're going to get a great sound because that center mic is going to be right where you want it. It's going to pick up all the sound you wanted. You have to have that some matrix, some difference matrix in order to decode the signal. Now, there are inexpensive microphones. I think Sony makes several of them that one might use on a mini disc or a small recorder that uses a mid-side, and it has the some matrix
logic built in.
Matrix built in right into the microphone. I don't know any model numbers. I think there's like a 907 or I can't remember. They make three or four that seem to be fairly good quality. They don't have great frequency response or anything. But, you know, if you know you're going to be doing a lot of recording that you may end up mixing into mono, it's a really good choice.
I think if users wanted to play with this, couldn't you take three, you know, relatively inexpensive condensers, set them up in that pattern, then use some software to, like I think SoundForge has a mid-side.
Oh, do they?
I believe so.
Decoding software. Oh, that would be neat.
And I guess you could kind of experiment at least,
yeah,
if you had three condenser mics available that were directional.
Right.
That might be something worth.
Yeah, because it's not easy to find a bi-directional microphone.
Right. You would probably spend some pretty good money just getting a figure eight pattern, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably so.
What I've seen a lot of cardioid condensers. What's a real popular, good quality, reasonably affordable omnidirectional condenser mic people would maybe want to check out?
Reasonably priced, that's the question. Well, I usually have my head in these high-end books dreaming of building my mic collection, so I'm really not familiar with inexpensive ones. For as far as portable recording goes, though, the sound professionals, they just have a myriad of omnidirectional small mics.
Okay.
A lot of them are really neat. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the ones that have these little, 4 or 5 inch goosenecks built right into the microphone. And basically, you can plug this. It's got an 1/8 inch stereo phone plug on the end of it. You just plug that into your recorder. And then you can just bend these little goosenecks around any way you want. And they make those in cardioid and omni configurations.
Hmm.
And you can also take the plug part of it, and they've got a special stand that will adapt it to a regular 5/8 inch stand. And then you would just use a jumper cable, not a jumper cable, but an extension cable that would have an XLR. I'm stuck in XLR world. It would have a miniature phone plug on one end and then a miniature phone jack on the other end. And then you could use that then, that same type of mic, in a remote situation where you would take it several feet away from your recorder.
So what other mics do you have in your personal collection?
Well, in my personal collection, my best mics are, I've got a pair of Neumann KM184s. They are small diaphragm. That's the first thing I thought of when Rob said small diaphragm Omni mics, because they make an Omni also, and I think it might be a KM183,
okay,
and then they make a hypercardioid, which is a KM185.
Hmm.
But then he did say the inexpensive part, so those mics are, well, I paid about $1,200 for a pair, and so,
wow,
yeah. But I'll have them the rest of my life.
So you got to be fairly serious to get in at that level.
I wasn't even that serious.
Oh, wow.
I just had to happen. That brings up another point that I should make when choosing a microphone. There are two ways to go about it. There are two ways that people go about it. And one of them is from an emotional,
right,
nostalgic,
yeah,
viewpoint. And the other is from a purely physical or technical viewpoint. And really, you need to take both into consideration because, I think Rob and I both would have the tendency to look at specs and let that drive our every thought. And sometimes that's not always the best thing. Sometimes you need to use a little bit of that practicality of as far as or you know the emotional aspect of a microphone. Don't let just because it costs a lot of money make you think that it's necessarily good. You can chop around and find a microphone that that possesses really good qualities and maybe not have to spend a lot of money for it.
Right.
So I think what I did on this microphone, I had read too many places where these were the desert island microphones of the recording. If you could only have one mic, and what would it be? So
those are small diaphragm cardioid microphones, right?
Right. Yeah, Neumann KM-184.
And you said they're very small, physically
very small, not much bigger than your index finger.
Wow.
And
that's nice.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What do you record with
them? I almost strictly use those for live recording. I'll use them in the near coincident version. Now, sometimes I'll use them coincident where they're on top of each other, okay. But normally I'll use them in a near coincident where the base of the microphone gets as close as they can be together, and then the element ends up being about 7 or 8 inches apart.
Mm-hmm. So do you have little tiny stands, or how do you do that?
Actually, the microphone came with a regular stand adapter, but it also came with a small stand adapter that fits an XLR barrel. So basically that my stand adapter is on the XLR barrel itself. The XLR is the
nice.
Type of connector, mm-hmm. and it's just the size of that barrel, so that enables me to get the mics as close as possible together.
And you have just two little stands, or?
No, I use one stand, and there's a T-bar across it that I made that just basically holds both mics on the same stand.
Are those readily available? You know, a stand?
Yeah, you can buy those. Okay. Two or three people manufacture them. I think Beyer may make one. I don't know who else.
So you have a pretty nice, convenient little setup there.
It is nice. And then you are, at this moment, borrowing one of my microphones that I actually bought for my son.
Right.
For stereo recording. It's a Rode NT4. And it element-wise, it's very similar to the Neumann's. It's a small diaphragm. And then it is in a coincident configuration where the mic elements are directly on top of each other. But the nice thing about it is you don't have to, it's all in one microphone. And you don't have to worry about making sure you have your alignment 90 degrees and perfectly on top of each other and everything, because they're permanently fixed in that coincident 90 degree
format. That's an interesting looking head on that microphone.
Yeah, and another nice thing about it is that it has its own power. As we said, I don't know if we said earlier, condenser mics have to have phantom power. It's somewhere between 9 and 52 volts they require. And this microphone has a 9-volt battery inside of it in the barrel, so that if you don't have phantom power readily available, it's a great choice. Mm-hmm. And so while the mic is fairly heavy for any portable standards, it does a wonderful job. And
It is. We'll probably discuss and maybe illustrate some of the things you can do with that mic on another show. I always reserve, you know, my view on something until I have like thoroughly checked it out. But in early preliminary results, only with headphones, say that this is an incredible, this and the MicroTrack together is an incredible portable pair. Definitely the best portable pair I've had access to.
Yeah.
Wow.
The noise level is just so much, signal to noise is so much better on this microphone than you're going to get with these typical Electret type microphones.
Yeah. It's a very hot mic.
It sounds good. You get the nice imaging. I walked around with it a bit yesterday. I'd need, though, to find a surgeon who can insert a 5/8 bolt in my forehead.
And why do you need a 5/8 bolt in your forehead?
Then I could put a stand adapter up there and not have to carry the damn thing.
Well, we probably got a hammer to insert it.
That would be attractive.
It is rather heavy, and you're not going to be... Oh, it must be noon, hopefully.
Yeah, first Tuesday of the month.
You're not going to be just lugging it everywhere you go. It's not terribly convenient. The trade-off for that is that you're going to do so much better than you would do with a couple of clip-ons, likely with a couple of binaurals in your ears, at least, you know, of the kind we've seen. It also comes with a cute little, I call it a dollhouse mic stand. Real small little mic stand that you can just...
dollhouse.
Unfold and a dollhouse mic stand, sit it on the table, and you're ready to go.
Actually, it didn't come with that.
Oh,
that's my deal. It just came with a stand adapter.
Shoot.
I'm sorry. Now his infatuation with the mic has diminished substantially.
Well, I only used that part once, briefly, and that wasn't the main appeal. Like I said, it's always good to get your story straight before you...
But one thing about that mic, too, if you are working with it in a field situation, people know you have a microphone. That thing is serious.
Oh, it's,
I mean, the binaurals, sometimes they'll miss, you know.
Yeah. And that's probably a goal. I would feel fairly uncomfortable thrusting this thing around, especially in a sensitive situation. But
yeah.
if you can manage it, I mean, I'm sure there's many other I'm sure there's many other successful pairs, but. Those two together.
Yeah, yeah. The nice thing about that mic is that, like I said, it's you don't have any fuss with aligning anything on it.
Oh yeah.
And it's one of the only, it is the only high quality stereo microphone that I know of that has its own power source.
Hmm.
Because you know you got the Audio Technica that takes the 1.5 volt battery, AT822 or something like that.
Something like that.
And I also have one of those. It's just really noisy.
Yeah. I have an old microphone from the 70s that Radio Shack used to sell. I don't know. It might have been built by Shure. Stereo
mm-hmm.
mic.
Mm-hmm.
AA battery. Unbalanced phono plugs.
Right.
I plugged that into the MicroTrack just after using the NT4, and what an incredible difference. I had to turn it all the way up, put the sensitivity on high, 27 dB boost, still wasn't loud enough, and I got the local FM radio station,
right,
and lots of noise and not enough gain.
Yeah.
So the NT4 is just shatters anything I know about
right.
stereo mics.
Right. Now, as I was talking about the sound professionals and these little mics that they have the goosenecks on them.
Right.
They have many to choose from, and they go really up in price. They get into several hundreds of dollars. And I would think that you would get similar, quality.
Performance
with those microphones, too. But it's rather hard to experiment, you know?
Right.
It's hard to get your hands on these mics
oh, yeah.
to try them out,
yeah.
and you don't want to...
A lot of places won't let you return mics anymore, either, for health reasons, right? I've seen
yeah.
that in some places.
Yeah, I have too.
I think what we all need is the ultimate non-intrusive, I don't realize I have it on, microphone with no self-noise and a recorder to record a signal to at least 20 to 20
right.
with little to no self-noise that runs on batteries for about 10 years.
Okay.
records to a medium that's just sort of ever-present. It's where you want it to be.
And removable.
And yeah, well, at least if not, you just have a way to wave your finger and it's on your PC.
And we want this recorder to have limiters too, right?
Bass roll-off, limiting, pretty much anything a person might need and for a variety of applications. Handle anything from dropping a piece of tissue paper on the floor to a thunderstorm or a fireworks display as far as SPL. Just... That would be the ultimate configuration. Well, I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon, if ever. But
back to reality.
We were trying to decide here a few days ago why we couldn't build a machine like that M-Audio.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not that expensive a part.
That's at least a little bit accessible, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, I bet... people would find out that those accessibility features would be very useful to sighted people as well.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you've been recording in the dark and want to check your meters or your battery status or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've told Rob before that I've spent some time down at the University of Louisville mixing sound for their jazz ensemble concerts. And they have a digital console now. And it's almost inaccessible for me. With a regular analog console, if you've got a problem somewhere and you've got to reach up and grab a knob to take care of it, it's nice having all those knobs laid out in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, but when you have to go through a menu and scroll through, you know, several different parameters to find what you're looking for to, you know, everybody's already gone crazy from feedback or whatever, you know, the problem was that you had to address. And so, yeah, I certainly know what it's like to have to scroll through and fumble through things, and having knobs at your fingertips that do one thing or maybe just a couple things are very desirable.
Hmm. Yeah.
Problem is, the more portable something is, the fewer knobs you can get on it.
Right. Yeah. I always find myself bumping that wonderful little wheel on the micro track. You know, you'll be listening to something and you'll accidentally wind up in the next track just because you, it's so easy to hit that little flipper thing.
Right. Up on the top right. Yeah.
And if you lock it, then it's just inconvenient at that point.
Johnny's also got some pretty extensive experience with the two Marantz, or at least the one Marantz digital recorder.
Yeah, we have a Marantz 670, I think the name of it is, model number.
Right.
Yeah, it does some things really well, but the mic preamps are weak. They're noisy, and they don't take a lot of gain. And the Neumann mics that I have, they have a similar output level to the NT4, so they're really hot, and it just doesn't take much at all to overload the mic pre's in the Marantz. Now I think they've maybe even stopped making that version because they have a 671 now, which looks exactly the same dimensionally, but it does 24-bit 96K, and it states that it has improved microphone preamp technology in it. So. Even though their engineers told me that everything was cool, everything was fine, that maybe my mics were just too hot. Somebody got the notion along the line there that they were a little weak.
Yeah, mic's too hot. That's a poor excuse.
It is.
Yeah.
The size of that Marantz surprised me, too. It seems to be a lot bigger than it needs to be.
Right. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Tascam portable DAT machine.
No.
It's similar in size to that. And I think they were looking for a replacement to that device. There are actually two or three manufacturers have solid-state recorders that are similar in size to that Marantz. And Tascam has come out with one now, which obviously is a direct replacement to their portable DAT machine. But I think they're more geared for field recording, for broadcast, you know, people in the news and that sort of thing.
Because they have a time code, right?
Well, I think the Tascam has a time code.
Right.
And, I mean, some of them actually have, you know, LAN connections and telephone jacks in them. And,
wow.
You know, enable you to get right straight up to the broadcast. But,
right.
Yeah, I really don't see any reason for that unit to be that big. Now, Marantz has a smaller version. It's, I think, a
PMD 660.
Yeah. And I've not had one of those in my hands, but it looks pretty good. It looks a little bit bigger than the R1, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit longer. But the nice thing about it has phantom power and accepts XLR inputs.
Right.
Yeah.
So you might be able to get it into your pocket, but if you did, your large XLR connectors would probably be a bit in the way.
Yeah.
I think if anybody wants to research that, that's, I believe, PMD 670, 671, and 660. I'm trying to think if there's any other products that we mentioned that people might want to research. The MicroTrack is, of course, M-Audio, m-audio.com. Let's see.
And what about that NT4 you were boasting? About.
You can learn more about that over at rodemic.com, RODEMIC.com.
And the R1?
Eddyroll, EDIROL.com. And, of course, you'll find these products at your favorite music retailer, usually or online music retailer. You probably won't be able to walk down the street and get one, but in your particular city, you might be lucky enough to do that.
Right.
So Rob's hands down a big R1 fan, and Johnny, it sounds like you're coming down on the side of the M-Audio.
Well, based on its size as much as anything, I just really like that put it in your pocket aspect. I like the phantom power too, although my Neumann mics, I didn't get the opportunity to try them with it, but the specifications call for like plus or minus 4 volts at 48 volts. So the output, phantom power output on the micro track is what, 30 volts?
Yeah, that's what you said.
I bet it would work.
Probably
just, you know, might slight
performance sacrifice.
Maybe a little noisier, maybe a little bit more clipping at high SPL. But
right, right. I don't know. I like the R1. I don't have a problem with it.
I don't know. I like the R1 just fine, but after experiencing the micro track with the NT4, of course, we're talking about a much more expensive setup at that point. I mean, if you're going to play NT4 and micro track, I think I've seen the NT4 for street price of about $450.
Right.
It's a $900 microphone. So you better decide, you know, if you want to lug that thing around, are you really going to use it? Is it what you need? And then, you know, street price on the micro track is, I don't know, $350 to $400.
Right. Mm-hmm. Another advantage of the micro track is if you're going to grow with your hi-fi gear, it has the Spitif.
It does.
Connectivity, which would enable one to, you know, I think, who is it, Apogee? I don't know. There's a couple manufacturers of microphone preamps that are extreme high quality and have, you know, digital output on them.
Right.
So then you're just using the micro track just as a storage device. But it's great for that because it's so small.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to worry about the noise generated by the circuitry in the microtrack when it writes to disk or when it does other memory type chores.
Yeah.
You can't monitor through the Spitif input, unfortunately. At least you couldn't with the shipped firmware. I haven't tried it with this latest beta firmware.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing you can't. The monitoring options on the microtrack are slim and none. While you're recording and that's it. There's no, even when you're paused, you can't set levels, monitor signals.
Aren't they supposed to rectify that with the next version, or there's going to be a firmware upgrade that will enable you to monitor?
Don't know.
No?
I'm not sure.
I heard that somewhere. I think I read it on a forum.
That'll be nice.
Yeah.
It's frustrating that you go into pause and you can't hear what you're doing.
It's terrible.
Very odd.
Yeah.
I don't know. R1 is still the great ultimate grab-it-and-go stereo portable recorder with its little built-in microphones. I mean, it has some, I call it kind of the R1 signature or flavor, where it sounds like an R1. If you listen to enough R1s, you'll notice that the built-ins have kind of a slight mid-hump, very bright highs, a little weak on the, you know, 8K-ish highs, and of course a lot of bass sensitivity. But and no handling noise in the low frequencies, just all high handling noise.
Right.
And these are the kind of things you have to deal with any mic or setup, is whatever its quirks, whatever its problems.
Right.
But with that aside, the R1's built-ins are quite good compared to most of these portable recorders built-ins. And it's very interesting to watch. I was telling the people on a previous show, this is a great time to be alive if you're interested in solid-state digital recorders.
It is.
Because I think we're just at the beginning.
I know. I hope they keep coming. I'm waiting for Mackie to get involved in it. They seem to make such good stuff.
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've considered emailing their marketing people and tell them, here's what everybody else has got wrong.
Right.
And, you know, do all the right things, and I think there's a big market for it. My kids are into music, and they go to camps and go to workshops and so forth. And when you go to these things, you see hundreds of kids with mini disc recorders, and these kids are dying to have something that they can, you know, a solid state recorder that they can quickly dump that information into their computer. Everybody just hates the mini disc. When you're trying to make a CD from it, you've got to take that time to, and you know, quality issues there with the real-time input into your computer.
Right, and the compression.
I've heard rumblings of a disk drive that reads those disks from the PC.
Yeah.
Really? I don't really know much about it.
Well, that would be interesting.
Of course, you still need a way to decode it, though.
Yeah.
Oh, mini disk was... I missed the mini disk thing. I mean, I watched it from afar.
Right.
But it was real exciting back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
But I fear its train has left the station.
Yeah. Well, I think the three of us here wanted to use the mini disc for something different than it was intended for.
Could be.
I think they were designed in, you know, primarily for playback, and you know, so folks could. The medium is inexpensive, so you could have a whole library of music in just a small box or whatever.
And I think that's nice.
I think that's what a lot of folks, or I think that's what the manufacturers intended their use. And then the publishers, I think, were trying to keep the manufacturers from having the digital in and out capability. Well, digital in they have, but the digital out they don't have. And I think that's for publishing reasons. But I don't know what they're doing to try to stop these solid state recorders. They've not been successful, so they're moving right along.
I think the thing that kept me out of the mini disc arena was the $1,000 price tag on the Sony home stereo model.
Right.
Back then, in the early days, I mean, it looked like a nice machine. You could do some editing on it and stuff, but $1,000 for something that was using a compression technology, back then, just seemed not such a great investment.
Well, any final words of wisdom for us, Johnny? I'll be the one.
Well, one other thing. If I were shopping for a microphone for portable recording, you know, a device to hook up to a mini disc or anything like that, I certainly would go the stereo route. I would not buy a mono microphone because, you know, it's so easy to have stereo everywhere on your PC, you know, your MP3 players, whatever. Stereo is there, so I wouldn't buy a mono microphone. If I could only buy one mic, I would buy definitely a stereo mic.
Stereo adds so much to it, too, so much ambience.
Right.
Even if it's not music, even if it's just outdoor sounds.
Right.
Oh, it's amazing just to hear you play back a recording, you walking around a house testing a mic, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
I know.
Probably not interesting to anybody else, but...
I borrowed your old Microtrack the other day, and I had it at home, and I was just testing it, and I was, you know, trying the different levels. I was going through different level settings with my microphone to try to find the optimum sound. And my wife was behind me knocking pots and pans around in the kitchen. I was in a adjoining room. And when I went back and did something else, and I know she left the room, she went outside. And when I played back what I was listening to, I heard the pots and pans again, and I did not correlate that to the recording that was made.
Right.
It sounded exactly live from the stereo microphone from the other room. And I turned around and I looked, and there was nobody there.
I love it when that happens.
Oh, yeah.
That's the experience people need to have when they're buying this kind of equipment, because that lets you know that it's going to do something maybe even a little bit more than you expected. You're going to get some nice surprises once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happens to me sometimes if I'm listening to some of these podcasts and people throw in an unexpected sound effect. Actually, it scares me.
Yeah.
Because I'll be so focused on what's being said, and I'll hear a sound, and I thought maybe the tea kettle caught on fire, or, you know, what the heck was that? But
So that would be, you know, my main advice is, you know, always buy a stereo mic these days if you can only buy one.
Yeah.
And whether it be a cardioid or Omni, you know, just depends on what you're after. If you want to concentrate more on the source of the sound and not so much of the ambience, then go for a cardioid. And then, but if you're wanting every detail of the room, good and bad, then the Omnis might be your best bet.
If we can just find an affordable pair of Omni condenser microphones.
Well, in the small configuration, you know, the quarter-inch size diaphragms that sound professionals and people like that sell, the same type of diaphragm that you have on the in-ears. You know, like I said, I've not tried any of those out, so I'm not... They're bound to be good, though. I mean, they're, you know, the information as far as their statistics and everything is just... Specifications are wonderful on them. So,
is there ever a time you'd use omnidirectionals in a stereo recording, in a pair? Or would that just be too?
It probably just picks crazy. Up a little bit too much. Yeah, a little bit too much sound. Unless that's what you really want. You know,
that's true. I guess it's all up to who's listening to it.
That's right.
That's. Might sound horrible to the next guy, but man, this is the best recording I ever made.
Yeah, generally speaking, those stereo mics are cardioid.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if anybody's still with us,
it's been a while. Turned into a very very deep discussion.
I'm sure there's thousands of questions I wanted to ask that I didn't get to or didn't remember.
Maybe we can persuade Johnny to come back at some point.
Sure.
I was going to write them down, but I didn't get to it.
Yeah, well.
Well, thank you very much, Johnny.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Cool tech.
Back to the basement.
Back to the dungeon with you.
So long.